you can explore an exclusive collection of case law at Decisus Law Reports. Browse a comprehensive collection of nearly 14,000 reports of Irish legal judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisus.ie to find out more.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 72 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs, presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister and mediator.
And myself, Mark Tottenham, barrister and editor of Decisus Law Reports.
Mark, good to see you as always.
And yourself.
Yeah, great. And last week, as you know, we had a very enjoyable and a very informative discussion with UCD academic Dr. Charles Garavan, who talked to us about that very complicated Apple case. Mm. I think we were jumping in with interventions. And anyway, every time I intervened, I think he was like, no, I think it's slightly different.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. But what was as interesting is the fact that he is a memory man. And,
the memory man. It's incredible, wasn't it? Incredible.
And you know, I found on Bookfinder a copy of his book on how to memorize everything you need for the leaving certificate. So I might have to say it again.
Well, I think he should release that and that will be a bestseller.
Well, it's been out of print for years. But
can we get a little bit of commission on that? We must talk to Cunnell. Cunnell will sort that out for us. Yeah. Absolutely. No, he was fantastic. Folks, if you haven't listened to it, it really is a brilliant explanation of a very complicated case, but he explains it brilliantly. He really does. Okay, well, tonight we're going to bring you part one of our interview, which took place at the conference held in Dublin Castle recently to mark the centenary of the courts. That's the 100th anniversary of the Courts of Justice Act, 1924. Mark, we had the pleasure of doing a public show with Supreme Court Judge Gerard Hogan, a good friend of this show, as you know, and also Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, Dermot Ferreter. And that was just brilliant, wasn't it?
It was a fantastic interview. And I'd have to say a fantastic conference as well. And really, Niamh Howland deserves a lot of credit for a really spectacular lineup. And I know a lot of these conferences sound a bit dull, but when you're there, I mean, this one was really fantastic.
Oh, no, it was
and
amazing.
I think the recordings are available for other parts of it as well. So definitely worth seeing if you can access some of the other talks.
Yeah, congratulations to Niamh on organising a really brilliant conference. Yeah. And it was suitable to, you know, it's a big deal, 100 years of the courts.
And it was in Dublin Castle where the courts had been sitting in 1924 because of the four courts having been blown up. It was great.
Okay, but first to three cases that you have identified from the Decisus website. Our first case tonight concerns an employment contract which had a non-compete clause. The High Court granted an interlocutory injunction to prevent a former employee from commencing work with a competitor, upholding a non-compete clause in the employee's contract, and that was pending a full trial. This is the case of Creganna Limited versus Cullen, and it's a decision of Mr. Justice Oisin Quinn.
Yeah, well, it's one of these medical device companies. Creganna was the plaintiff in the case, and the defendant was somebody who was quite a senior executive. I think he'd originally been employed as the European sales manager. He'd been promoted to the position of global account manager. And as you say, he'd had a non-compete clause and then tried to go and work for a competitor. And so they applied for an interlocutory injunction. And of course, the test, there are various tests in relation to an interlocutory injunction. One of the questions is whether damages are an appropriate remedy. One of them is what the balance of justice is pending the full trial of the action, and what they held here that was that it was appropriate to prevent him taking
it's kind
up
of an interesting decision. I mean, I thought the mood was non-compete clauses were. The courts were kind of,
I think that's very
significant.
I think
the world has changed with that decision a little bit. Very interesting decision. Okay. Next to a succession case where the High Court had to deal with a claim by sisters against their other sister, who was the administrator of their mother's estate. Judge Kennedy, who was the presiding judge in this case, allowed the claim to continue and granted an order restraining the defendant from dissipating the proceeds of the sale of the former family home. This is a case of Byrne versus Arnold, and it's a High Court decision of Mr. Justice Kennedy.
Yeah, so what happened here was that the father had died years and years ago. The mother was continuing to live in the house, and it transpired that on the administration of the father's estate, the other siblings, the sisters who were the plaintiffs in this case, had signed or had appeared to sign certain disclaimers that had been given to them by the defendant, who then became the testatrix of her mother's estate or administrator of her mother's estate. It transpired that that she herself had signed one of her sister's signatures on the disclaimer, saying that she'd been told to do so by the sister. But all of the sisters, the other sisters, the ones who had signed, said that they had been told that they were signing it for a different reason. The signatures had been procured several years previously, but because of the issue of fraudulent misrepresentation, whether the disclaimers had been obtained on a fraudulent basis, an application to strike out the proceedings failed because there was clearly an arguable case to be heard.
Okay, very good. Really interesting, that one, Mark. Well, next to a defamation action and whether it should or should not have been brought in the United States of America. The High Court granted leave to both parties in this case to file evidence in an application to place a stay on the Irish defamation proceedings. This is the case of Ganley versus Cable News Network. I think that's better known as CNN. And that's a decision of Mr. Justice Simons in the High Court.
An article or material had been published in relation to whether the White House under Donald Trump had put pressure on the Department of Defense to award a lease of spectrum, I think that's in relation to mobile phones, to a company that was connected with the plaintiff. He then brought the action in Ireland. And the application was made as to whether Ireland was the forum non conveniens, as we like to say. And Mr. Justice Simons felt that neither party had put forward sufficient information as to what the appropriate forum was for these proceedings. And so basically he allowed the matter to be adjourned in order that each party could then file sufficient information for him to determine this issue.
Okay, so that's going to be back before the court at a later
stage.
Okay, so back shortly with the first part of our interview with Professor Diarmaid Ferriter and Mr. Justice Gerard Hogan. Clio is the leading provider of cloud-based legal practice management software, providing lawyers with an easy-to-set-up, affordable solution to manage and grow your firm more effectively, more profitably, and with better client experiences. Start a free trial today. Visit clio.com/IE.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
Okay, folks, first of all, can we just say a huge thank you on behalf of myself and Mark and the Fifth Court podcast for being invited to this auspicious conference today. Thank you to Dr. Niamh Howlan. It is wonderful for us to be here, Mark, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really fantastic. It's been an amazing collection of speakers so far, and more to look forward to this afternoon.
And this is our third live show. Previously, we did the Electric Picnic, which we're always mentioning, so we have to stop saying that. And we also did the Law Society, and now we're in Dublin Castle. So
slightly different attendance here from the Electric Picnic.
Yes, yes. So we hope, anyway, this next hour or so will be very interesting. It's going to be conversational style, and we are delighted to have our two guests here. Supreme Court Justice Mr. Gerard Hogan and Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD, Diarmaid Ferriter. So, Mark, do you want to kick off?
Sure. So, today is the 12th of April, 2024, and it is 100 years to the day from the enactment of the Courts Act, which effectively put into place our court system. We were coming out of a world war, War of Independence, the Civil War, and a parallel, effectively a rebel court system. And so perhaps, Professor Ferriter, if you could just give us an overview. You spoke this morning at length, but if you could give a brief overview, where was the country in 1924, and was the new Courts Act destined to be a success and here 100 years later?
I think I would use the word fraught when I think of that post-Civil War period. It's a period of transition. It's also a period of recovery, given the scale of what has happened the previous decade and the trauma associated with it, of which we know more now, I think, in relation to how it impacted on people psychologically, as well as people who were dealing with loss and grief. And also a young generation of politicians who are charged with the task of putting in place the building blocks, the foundations of the new state, getting that right. That is no easy task, of course, and by no means was it going to be an automatic success. One of the difficulties facing those trying to build a state, of course, is the extent to which it's contested. There's a very sizable anti-treaty sentiment in Ireland. Sinn Féin, anti-treaty Sinn Féin, won 44 seats in the general election of 1923, suggesting that there was a very significant strong political base.
And these are effectively people who don't recognise the new state.
They don't recognise.
And is there any guarantee that they'll recognise the new courts either?
Absolutely not. No. And there's also, of course, the question of them abstaining from the Dáil. They don't recognise the Dáil or the legitimacy of the Dáil. So there's, in effect, there's no sizable opposition. The Labour Party, to its credit, is doing its utmost to try and provide parliamentary opposition, largely a constructive opposition. But it's quite isolated as a political force because it has been squeezed by the civil war divisions. So there are those obvious political divisions. But there's also the question, and particularly when you consider the challenge of a new court system, of establishing a consensus about what constitutes authority. And that includes legal authority.
Of course.
And trying to get dissidents, as they would have been seen, to accept that there needed to be a consensus around law and order.
And dear, but if I can come in there, I mean, when you say what constitutes authority, like in the period from about 1918 until independence and until the treaty was signed, there was a form of authority in terms of the Dáil courts. Mm. So there was, you know, in terms of administrative functions for the new fledgling state, there was precedence there. There was, you know, an apparatus of some sort. So can you take us through that and how that might have impacted on people's thinking as they tried to set up the new country?
That does help. I mean, one of the challenges during the War of Independence was to establish a counter-state, not just in relation to the administration of justice, but also by running local government, by trying to implement promises that had been made in 1916 and in 1919 with the democratic program in relation to local authority institutions and the workhouses and so on. And a lot of people devote considerable effort to that, including some of those who came to prominence in politics in the 1920s and indeed in the legal profession, because they had been involved in that counter-state exercise. And they do develop a degree of allegiance in relation to those particular initiatives. People are prepared, if they're signed up to the aims of the War of Independence, to recognise that there is a need for policing, the Republican police force, for example, that we don't hear an awful lot about, that the need for courts to operate, that are Republican courts, that are Irish courts, that there's a need for local government to be controlled by Irish nationalists. So there is something of an infrastructure in place. It's interesting, for example, even in terms of those who come to prominence in politics, that both W.T. Cosgrave and Kevin O'Higgins, as leader of government, as president of the Executive Council and Minister for Home Affairs, respectively, both cut their teeth in the Sinn Féin Ministry of Local Government during the War of Independence. So they do have considerable administrative experience.
Just kind of in terms of the Irish experience or the international experience, I mean, this notion of an infrastructure such as Dáil Courts side by side with a military campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not unusual.
It is unusual.
It's kind of impressive, dare I say it.
Oh, it's very impressive. Yeah, it is impressive. But it also serves to show that the War of Independence wasn't just a military war of independence. It wasn't just a propaganda war. It was a political war in a very serious sense. And that wasn't just about an underground Dáil meeting and issuing declarations. It was about taking these ministries very seriously and taking the machinery of government very seriously. And they were very preoccupied as well with the idea that we have to be seen to be fit to run our own affairs. They took that challenge very seriously. And in some cases, they rose to the challenge quite successfully.
So can I bring in Mr. Justice Hogan here? We've heard a description of, you know, a fraught situation, a parallel state. We've got people who effectively have been tearing us down the old state system. They've been putting in a rebel state, but it's obviously there's still a functioning established state in place. When the new Courts Act comes in, there's been a sort of an interregnum after the treaty. The existing Crown Courts were still in existence for a short space of time. When the new courts came in, just listening to some of the papers this morning, to a certain extent, they're reviving the structure of the old courts, and to a certain extent, they're bringing new functions. And I wonder, could you briefly outline to what extent would the new courts have been recognisable to the people who had been in courts, say, prior to 1914, prior to the Great War? Is it a very different system?
Yes, it is different, but I think on the whole, there was, at that point, greater continuity between the let's say 1916, 1918, 1919, pre-War of Independence court system, and that which emerged from the Courts of Justice Act of 1924. That's not to say that there weren't really important changes. And the fact the district court system was, I suppose, in some ways half modelled on the Doyle Court's local experience, and that no longer had you got resident magistrates, but you had fully qualified, full-time professional judges who are not just simply drawn from local worthies who might be expected to be sympathetic to the Dublin Castle administration. That was a huge change.
Could we just briefly touch on the resident magistrate situation? Because a lot of people will be familiar with Somerville and Ross, the notion of the, I think the resident magistrate in that case was somebody who came from England and was literally sitting on sort of local disputes.
Yes.
I mean, was that the way justice was functioned in rural areas in the pre-independence period?
Yeah, it was. And of course, ever since there was a big change post-famine, the original civil bill court, which emerged into the county court, and which are to some degree the precursor of the modern-day circuit court. The modern-day circuit court is, of course, a big change in the county court, but it's still close enough to the county court system. The district court was possibly the biggest single institutional change that was different from what had gone before.
And it was different from the petty sessions.
And made the whole system of petty sessions and registered magistrates and a system where, of course, change had come in 1898 with the Local Government Act, which set up local authorities for the first time, and many of the functions which up to that point had been administrative functions for roads and workhouses and so on, which had been vested in resident magistrates and petty sessions courts, now were moved from, if you like, a judicial or quasi-judicial branch into local authority systems. So the change had been coming. But in terms of the court structure itself, I would say the district court was possibly the single biggest change. Once you went up the court system, obviously there was significant changes in personnel, but much remained the same. In the sense that the mode of address, the gowns and so on, which had been part of the radical changes which a lot of people like Hugh Kennedy, the first Chief Justice, wanted, hadn't then come to pass. That was only to come to pass much later. And I suppose just to anticipate by memo, I would say if you look over a 100-year compass, it has taken 100 years or taken a significant period for there to be the development of what you might call an autochthonous Irish legal system and jurisprudence that is not just simply a carbon copy of that which prevailed in the Strand of London.
Okay, and Dermot, if I can bring you back in, Mr. Justice Hogan here just referred to Hugh Kennedy, who became the first Chief Justice post the 1924 Act and was Attorney General to the fledgling Executive Council post-treaty. He's a fascinating character, isn't he?
Oh, he is. And Elisa Holland, who was the archivist in UCD in 1989, set about the task of trying to catalogue and organise his very, very extensive papers. He was very conscious of their own importance, of the importance of those papers, and his own place in history, let it be said. And, you know, we've Robert Dudley Edwards, one of my predecessors, who was Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD, to thank as well for his initiatives in the late 60s and early 1970s to establish the business of archives on a very serious footing in Ireland, including in UCD, and encouraging the acquisition of papers. And they do include that collection. They're fascinating because of the transition and the level of detail that you get, but also because of his character, because he expresses himself in often a very colourful way and a very forthright way. He has very strong views on a variety of different topics, and it's not just about legal technicalities. You know, he's a very strong nationalist. And he has very firm views on the situation regarding the border and the new state of Northern Ireland, as well as all of these obvious legal issues. And he's also,
he took a very hard line, as you know, he was an Attorney General who presented in court.
Yeah.
And he takes a very hard line on behalf of the Executive Council.
Oh, absolutely. But that would have been seen as an extension of the need to solidify the authority of the state at that time, you know. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, just, I mean, like, as you say, he's kind of a nationalist. He's kind of a radical.
Yeah.
He wants to, in one way, move the courts away from the traditional Anglo model.
Yeah.
But yet, when he, as in his capacity as Attorney General, he's quite authoritarian. He was quite kind of establishment.
Yeah, very much. And I mean, like, I don't think that's particularly unusual. If you look at how they think about their different roles and also the idea of them being a product of a particular period of nationalism, And they have their own views on that. He also becomes a politician, you know, as a Cumann na Gael TD, even though he would have been on record as suggesting that it wouldn't be wise to mix the law with politics to that extent. So what is the reason for that? You know, why does he see that? Because he responds to a plea from W.T. Cosgrave, the head of government. And there are also, throughout his papers, numerous examples of the strains of trying to manage that transition, the business of running government and the civil service. It's not just about the court system. It's also about legislation.
Yes.
And it's about what his role is in relation to legal advice around that and getting it right. And again, that is, I mean, his intray was extraordinary. You know, and if you do look at it sometimes and wonder how he managed to, how he managed his workload.
In your talk earlier, which was absolutely fascinating, you talked about the relationship he had with W.T. Cosgrave, and they were close.
They were,
And he referred to him as the Brehon, I think, you know?
Yeah, that's an affectionate mode of address, I think. And I find that particularly interesting because Cosgrave's quite an elusive character. He didn't leave behind a substantial archive. It can be very difficult to penetrate the mind of W.T. Cosgrave. Michael Laffin has done a fine job in the most recent overview of his life that we have. But it can become a particular challenge when a character like Cosgrave doesn't leave a substantial body of material behind. Like if you go in to look at De Valera's papers in UCD, a politician of the same generation on the other side, you just get this voluminous detail that you just don't get with Cosgrave. So the exchanges between himself and Kennedy are particularly interesting because of that. Now, it is tetchy on occasion, the correspondence, inevitably, given the tensions that were being generated. And at one stage, Cosgrave was actually admonishing Kennedy for not responding quickly enough to some particular concern that he had. And again, that was also about the what was deemed to be the urgent priorities when it came to various matters.
And like I referred there to the fact that W.T. Cosgrave referred to Hugh Kennedy as the Brehon. Mm. And, you know, his thumbprints or his fingerprints are all over basically how maybe, I suppose, law and the court service developed in the new fledgling state. It is interesting that in the Dáil courts, there was some sort of reference to the Napoleonic Code. I don't think it really happened that much. I think it was always the common law or, you know, the potential for Brehon law to come into play. Hugh was into getting rid of the robes, etc. But generally, the common law was maintained, Gerard. Isn't that what happened?
Yeah, it was. And Kennedy certainly railed against what he saw the conservatism, the natural conservatism of the Irish bar. And there was what he saw a sort of certain counter-revolutionary tendencies in the court system once it was set up in 1924. And his diary is full of perspicacious observations about his, you know, his colleagues and what was happening and so on. And I suppose you can, I should say two things really about, we could say a lot about Hugh Kennedy, but two things about Hugh Kennedy. First is that he saw the Free State Constitution as the, if you like, the guarantor of the sovereignty of the state. I mean, to use a modern phrase, it's part of the constitutional identity of the state being certainly internally sovereign. And he wanted to advance that as much as he could. There's a case which is now, I think, really forgotten for the most part, called Ray Reid from 1927, dealing with a bankruptcy summons, in which Kennedy gives in great detail, sort of chapter and verse, from the orthodox Cumann na Gael position as to what was the root and title, you know, what was the standing of the treaty, what was this, it with Dáil Éireann as a constituent assembly creating the constitution of the Irish Free State, what were the limits of that? And you saw that again in December 1934 in his judgment in the state Ryan and Lennon. And I have to say, I mean, part of it, of course, was that his dissent in the state Ryan and Lennon was he saw that the majority judgment was signalling the death knell to the Irish Free State constitution. And I suppose he feared that we would then be back really constitution-less and back just simply within, you know, the total orbit of the common law. And so his judgment, his dissent in the state Ryan and Lennon in December 1934, it really is, you know, is a magnificent achievement, but it also reflects, I suppose, the frustration of somebody who had been on the Constitution Committee in 1922 and who saw its work being undone. First by what he would have regarded, I suppose, as renegades in the Irish Court of Appeal in their very last judgment in May 1924, as they were going out the door, as it were. To use Mr. Justice Collins's phrase from this morning, they unraveled a thread in the Free State Constitution with their interpretation of it, which led to its ultimate undoing. And that, I think, is insufficiently appreciated today. But as far as State Cooney or Regina Cooney and Clinton's, Rex Cooney and Clinton's condemned in May 1984, Kennedy, as Attorney General, was furious that he was being invited by the bench to say that, in essence, that the Constitution, the Free State, was simply just a statute, could be amended implicitly in the ordinary way, and so on. Of one thing I'm fairly convinced is that while Kennedy detested De Valera, he, a bit like Gavin Duffy, would have been totally at home post-1937 had he lived to see it.
Okay.
Can I bring you back to the changes in the Courts Act? And I think there are two changes we heard about this morning that I think have had lasting impact and that we're very aware of today. One of which is the big increase in the jurisdiction of the Circuit Court, which was resisted by the Dublin Bar, but clearly meant that the legal profession around the country had more work to do. And secondly, the retirement age for judges, which I hadn't realized before. We were the first country in the common law world to introduce a retirement age for superior court judges. Up until that time, they could carry on work well into their 80s if they lived that long.
Well, that's true. I mean, it was introduced in the UK in 1959, and the last person to get advantage, so to speak, of the pre-59 dispensation was none other than Lord Denning himself, who had the well-worn joke towards the end that he had all the Christian virtues bar that of resignation, but he ultimately was, in a sense, forced to resign. You see that orthodox common law thinking, you know, in the Federalist Papers, which explain the reason why, for good or for ill, US Supreme Court judges have life tenure, and all federal all federal judges in the United States have life tenure. And indeed, there's no strict limit as such in the Court of Justice in Luxembourg. There is in Strasbourg of 70. So, yes, that was again, a radical but possibly underappreciated innovation in 1954 in having these retirement ages for judges. But of course, everybody thinks it's a good idea until certain dates arrive. Yes, yes.
One other thing I'd like to ask about in terms of the early court system is that until 1935, there still remained an available appeal to the Privy Council. And obviously, that's a two-edged sword, because on the one hand, it meant that we weren't entirely independent. On the other hand, and I think we've seen in recent years, some countries are actually asking to have an appeal to the Privy Council because it gives a certain respectability to their own legal systems. So I'm just wondering, is there a way in which you can say that the having that appeal to the Privy Council was almost like a kind of a stabilizer or a, should we say, a training wheels on the new court system that mightn't have had the respect either within the country or without the country that it mightn't otherwise have had?
I think that was certainly the way the British saw it. The then Permanent Secretary, the Lord Chancellor's Department, Sir Claude Schuster, who was, you know, very influential in British legal circles in the 1920s and 30s, had a very dim view of the, irrationally dim view of the quality of the Irish judiciary, and you know, thought that most of them would be corrupt and so on. That wasn't, of course, the case, and it was insisted on as part for two reasons, I suppose, partly to assuage the concerns of the unionist and religious political minorities. That was one concern. And the second concern was, of course, the idea of preserving the unity of the dominions and the unity of the common law. Now, I mean, that was certainly a feature with dominions that had willingly embraced the Privy Council system. So you see, up to the 1960s, early 70s, important private law questions, say, on contract and crime and so on, coming from the High Court of Australia to the Privy Council. That's no longer the case, of course, but I think it never really got off the ground. I mean, there was, in the end of the day, only six or seven appeals, actually, cases where the Privy Council granted leave. Kennedy had urge the Privy Council and was relatively successful in the first applications for leave in 1923 in persuading a fairly benign Privy Council not to grant leave, save in exceptional cases. And that was continued. There was one, I think, Privy Council itself made a mess of things in the Wigan-Cochrane case about the interpretation of Article 10 of the treaty dealing with compensation for civil servants. And Lord Cave, who gave the first judgment to Privy Council in 1925, made a gross error on dates and indeed gave a sort of a deathbed confession to say that he had actually got it all wrong. And they had to send it back to the Privy Council again under special legislation. And ultimately, the whole Wigan-Cochrane thing was solved by an agreement by both governments to amend the treaty by legislation. So the Privy Council really had not covered itself in glory. And then when it began to become active again in the late 20s, the Oireachtas came up with an ingenious solution, was that as soon, and we saw this in the Bray Urban District Council copyright case, which concerned the copyright in a tune played by a bandsman on the Bray Esplanade, and went ultimately from Supreme Court to the Privy Council. Supreme Court probably got the interpretation of the Berne Convention and the copyright issue wrong, but the Oireachtas didn't care. As soon as leave was granted, they passed legislation, the Copyright Amendment Act 1929, which declared the law to be as the Supreme Court said it was, and thereby essentially frustrated the appeal to the Privy Council. And then, of course, by 1931, you had the Statute of Westminster, and then in June 1935, you had Warren, the Attorney General of the Irish Free State, Lord Sankey, saying, well, look, the effect of the Statute of Westminster is to be to give the Free State the power to tear up the treaty, and this is something which is a matter of law they've done. So the Privy Council, while it was just, it was one thing that unified all wings of Comyn na Gael, never mind the anti-treaty side, they in detestation of the idea of an appeal to the Privy Council, but it never really got off.
Okay, and Dermot, can I just bring you in there? And we're going to move on. We're going to talk about the courts over the course of 100 years. So we'll move on from this area after this. But I'm curious about, I mean, obviously the treaty, Kevin O'Higgins in particular, I think felt boxed in by the treaty, that they couldn't depart from the traditional way law had been established on the island. That was a commitment that they had made as part of the treaty. But the issue of imagery, it's a new state. I mean, we know that the state that kind of implemented the treaty effectively, you know, took on board the existing structures in terms of government, departments, civil service, etc., in terms of administering the new state. But in terms of the courts, there was some kickback and some attempt. I noticed you referred to a Francis Bigger earlier in your talk, who was objected to wigs, for example, and gowns, and wanted the imagery of something independent, something distinctive, something different from what had gone before when we were part of the British Empire.
Well, they saw it as a glorious opportunity to put their own stamp on, you know, not just in relation to the establishment of a new court system, but how they would appear. Could there be distinctly Irish garb? Could they draw from the well of Irish history to come up with something? They put quite a lot of effort into this. Now, there were disagreements about that, because you always had elements who regarded this as far too radical a step, particularly at that time, I suppose, who pushed back against it. Now, these rows mostly went on behind closed doors. You know, it's not as if this was a matter of intense public discourse. But, Hugh Kennedy would have communicated that idea that this is relevant to the man on the street, as he put. You know, what are you seeing in terms of the representatives of the law in Ireland and representatives of the courts? What are you seeing? You know, is this just a colonial imagery that you're dealing with? So that you can understand how deep feelings would have been on this.
Absolutely.
And Francis Bigger, obviously, he had his own a particular issue with the Whigs, you know, but that was part of a wider tapestry of opposition to what was regarded as outdated and inappropriate.
If I can bring you in on this one, just as Mark said, there was a pushback from the Dublin Bar. The Dublin Bar seemed to be very resistant, and certainly the expansion of the circuit court throughout the country for various different reasons, some good, some maybe not so good. But in terms of the Dublin Bar, I mean, a lot of the eminent barristers of the day retained the title KC well into the 30s. Mm. I think it was Gavin Duffy was the first to call himself a senior counsel and dispense with the KC.
Yes, exactly. I suppose in 19, you know, at the time of the War of Independence, the time of course, the Justice Act 1984, I mean, the bar had been traditionally Unionist and Protestant, you know, coming from that, you know, double minority tradition. Now, things were changing and would have changed anyway. What is a surprise slightly to me is that when Fianna Fáil came to power in 1932, and especially when P.J. Rutledge became Minister for Justice in 1933, I mean, he had been an anti-treaty officer, wounded, very seriously wounded in the Civil War. I mean, it's a bit of a surprise to me that the De Valera and Rutledge did not press for further changes then. In other words, I can understand Glenavy ridiculed in the Shannon some of these drawings, sort of beautiful drawings which we can see at these exhibitions.
This is for the new roads.
For the new roads.
This was Lord Glenavy.
Lord Glenavy, Lord Chancellor. Here, like the Shannon and so on. He ridiculed this and said it was like a jockey's apparel. So you could understand how Cosgrave and Kennedy wanted to consolidate with the Courts of Justice Act 1924 and be unwilling to kind of rub it into the bar any further changes than they were already going to have to accommodate. But it is slightly surprising to me that De Valera and Rutledge in the 1930s didn't, as it were, press on from that and insist that, for instance, the habit, which has only changed within my own practicing lifetime, of referring to judges as my lord, that be stopped, and you know, that there would be new gowns, again, something that's only happened in, you know, within the last century, since the Supreme Court changed in 2011. From
Chief Justice Murray.
Yeah, Chief Justice Murray. And then
can you see yourself in the gowns that we see at five? Some of them are a combination of purple, blue and orange, I think.
They might be terribly practical in bad weather, but in another life, Mark, I am envious of
the headdress is particularly interesting.
It's an interesting point about the transition from Cumann na Gael to Fianna Fáil government. It happens less than 10 years after the end of the Civil War. Ireland recovered very quickly from its Civil War, and we need to remember that when you consider not just the change of government, but the solidifying of that consensus around the institutions of the state in the 1930s, during a very difficult decade for democracy throughout Europe. It's Peter Mayer, the late political scientist, often asked us to make more of that, and I can see where he was coming from. And I think the point that's being made, as you know, as to why they didn't push further, that's related to that. You know, what do you need to prioritize when it comes to your Republican agenda in the 1930s, now that you have power? And De Valera was cautious about a lot of different things, and even in relation to who would be working with him within the civil service. Maurice Moynihan, for example, had become secretary to the government. De Valera knew damn well that Maurice Moynihan was on the other side when it came to the treaty divide. And as Moynihan put it, he never asked me how I voted and I never told him. But it was known. But the reason De Valera wanted to keep him on was because of that need for continuity. So there was a recognition that in a very public and obvious way, the treaty had to be torn up. You know, you have to recast Anglo-Irish relations. But even the British governments discovered that De Valera was not the wild man of propaganda, that they could do business with him, that he was reasonable. And even at a later stage, you know, De Valera would have mused on the idea of not being completely opposed to Ireland remaining in the Commonwealth, had there been some settlement over the border. So, you know, he wasn't, and he'd often attested to this in private, that, you know, he was not one of the diehards, as he put it. And I think that's relevant to what's been spoken about with regard to how far they were going to push certain things.
I mean, if I may just to follow on from what Dermot said, you could add to Maurice Moynihan in a legal context, obviously John Hearn, who of course didn't even come from Sinn Féin background, was really the total architect of the Constitution. And De Valera, you know, depended so heavily on Hearn.
And putting James Gagan into justice.
And putting James Gagan into justice in 1932, 1933. But, Hearn did have a plan for a constitutional court. And that was very seriously entertained right up until the last minute. And again, it was the same sort of thing. De Valera drew back from that. And it was the same sort of thing as My Lord and Gans and so on. It would have been just too radical a change to be superimposed on a very conservative and to tread softly.
Yes.
And he did, of course, give kind of Supreme Court a backhanded compliment in the process, saying that he, in the end, he really couldn't find anybody better to interpret the Constitution than the Supreme Court. Now, it wasn't glowing praise, but it was more or less quite grudging in the end.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
So that's all for this edition of the Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Thank you to our guests, Mr. Justice Gerard Hogan and Professor Diarmaid Ferriter. And we'll be back next week with the second part of that interview. Mark, it's cooking nicely, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, with two such well-informed, erudite people, we just need to sit back and listen to what they have to say.
Oh, absolutely. The two of them were fantastic. So before we go, I'd like to say a big thank you to our producer, Conal O'Moroyne, and to Peter Rice of the Dublin South Podcast Studios for their wonderful work in recording this show. So for me, Peter Leonard.
Myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.
Never miss a vital Irish legal judgment. Check out Decisis Law Reports, where you'll find a fully indexed collection of all Irish judgments delivered since 2011. Visit decisis.ie to find out more.